Across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
On FM, digital and your mobile.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
I'm going to read you the menu. It's fantastic.
So we get better flavour because of the fen soil.
I've drunk more beer since I came here and bought my two barrels than I've ever done in my life before, I think.
I shouldn't have said almonds. They don't make it from almonds.
So you've got this big sticky mess when you start off.
Pizza pot pies.
My wife's cakes are selling up hot cakes. Brilliant, thank you.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Delicious.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Flavour with Matt Bentman, Sue Bailey and me, Alan Alder. And thanks to Ollie for the last hour. Today, how are producers and retailers adapting to the lockdown? We hear from farmer Simon Steele from Cambridge's Sunday Market, Claire Rosier from the Larder at Burwash,
and Sam Owens from Thirsty about an interesting online initiative. It's also the 20th anniversary of Simon's stall at the Sunday Market, so he will be reflecting on that later in the programme. In addition, for those whose children are getting seriously bored, we bring you some advice on teaching cooking from Tina Roche of the Cambridge Cookery School and Karen Allworth from Always Time to Bake. And on the subject of baking, Sarah Lavelle will be talking about the book Super Sourdough by James Morton.
We also have a lot of news updates about local providers who are either home delivering or open for the safe collection of food and drink in and around Cambridge.
And that's all coming up today on Flavour.
Simon Steele farms at Mayfield Farm, that's between Littleport and Downham Market, and he sells the produce at his very popular and good vegetable stall on Cambridge's Sunday Market. I asked him what it's been like selling to customers face to face. Do they comply with physical distancing rules?
Like everybody, we really didn't know, or we still don't know, just how to deal with things. From being a self-selection business on the market with a large number of customers.
Have you any idea how many customers on a typical Sunday?
About 350, 400, perhaps sometimes even more than that. But yeah, so the concept of doing it as we were just didn't work with the way we're having to run the business now. I mean,
Well, people were crowding.
People were crowding around. Vast majority were fine, but others were just darting in and out, and it just made the whole situation untenable, both for us, for the customers, and for the staff. And just couldn't see how it was going to work anymore. So we took a week's break when I went delivering boxes and around Cambridge, which was an interesting experience. And I've seen parts of Cambridge that I never knew existed.
All right, and how long did that take you then?
I was out on the road for about 18 hours that day. And I mean, the customers were great. I mean, we got a really good response when we were going delivering around, but in terms of practicality, it didn't work. It wouldn't work long term.
Exhausting.
Yeah, but we at that point we also called in, and I spoke to several other market traders here who traded that second weekend, and they all said that actually people were much more aware of social distancing and just giving other people respect and room. And so we took the decision that we would actually come back onto the market but sell boxed vegetables or boxed selection of vegetables on the market rather than having self-selection. And we've been very fortunate that the customers have been very loyal and have stuck with us and now come down. And actually, many of them say it's their heart of the week to come down, to come into the town, have their exercise and get their veg or their food at the same time. Because there's a nice selection of traders on the market now. So you can do your fruit, your veg.
You can do most of your food shopping, really, can't
Absolutely.
You? If you go for fresh produce, that
yes.
is.
Yes.
Yeah. And I've noticed people do keep their distance as well.
Very much so, yes. They are much. And it's safe for everybody then. It means that we're getting an outlet for the veg.
Yeah, one of the things that I've really enjoyed about coming to your stall is the banter, the conversation, people in the queue talking about what you can do with that bit of vegetable, and somebody say, "That's a great idea. This is what I do."
I think that's sort of lost, really, but I suppose you can't have everything.
You can't. It's come back a little bit. I noticed, I mean, today there was just a little bit more banter around, and people had sort of relaxed slightly and were talking at a distance, but were talking to each other. And there were two or three groups of people talking again at distance. So that it is returning slightly, but yeah, no, that real community banter has at the moment slipped away a bit.
Yeah.
That was Simon Steele, and if you want to collect vegetables from him at his stall, email simonorganiccamb@gmail.com, simonorganiccamb@gmail.com, and say whether you want a two-person box, which is £12, or a family box, which is £22.
Collection is at Cambridge Market on Sundays between 8 a.m. and 2 p.m. 5 kilo bags of potatoes are also available at £4. He does have a small number of additional items for you to self-select whilst you're there as well.
And we'll be hearing more about Simon's stall and its history later in the programme.
But before then, another popular food retailer is the larder at Burwash in Barton. I spoke with Claire Rosier about how what their customers want has changed during lockdown.
We still get the odd person who comes in and wants, you know, a lovely piece of cake as an afternoon treat, but we've really seen a shift over to more kind of grocery items. I would say people are using us for their kind of weekly shop now, rather than, you know, going to a deli for a few treats. So we are selling less cakes, but yeah, we've definitely seen a rise in store cupboard products. Green grocery has gone through the roof. We're on about 400% turnover of that compared to last year. What we've also seen is obviously people are being very savvy about the way they shop. People don't necessarily want to leave the house very often and put themselves at risk. So I just pulled some figures off of our till system before I came to speak to you. And just to give you an idea, so our average basket spend last April was just over £11. And this year, April, our average basket spend is just over £28. So it's over doubled, which is an incredible amount.
That's impressive. And that's really nice that people are thinking now about shopping local. And also, presumably, a lot of your green grocery type produce is more locally sourced as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. So we have wonderful Tyler, who actually rents some land from the farm here. So he's growing some organic leaves and things at the minute. We grow our own asparagus on the farm, so we get that picked every single morning, so that's about as fresh as it can be at the moment. But we have these wonderful greengrocers called Les Ward, who do our green grocery for us. And that's been such a string to our bow, really, during all of this, because those guys really know their stuff. They go down to London 6 mornings a week for us and pick up the veg. So actually, when the supermarkets couldn't get hold of any fresh produce, we had, you know, probably one of the best ranges in the city, which was amazing. And that, I think, that definitely played a part in people realizing that the small shops were available. I think when you work for a small independent business, you're so much more versatile. You know, there's actually one person making a decision and you can implement that change really quickly, as opposed to maybe, you know, a big corporate and they have to go through so many hoops in order to make a decision and make changes to their structure.
So you can really be very nimble. What have you noticed with your independent suppliers? What sort of effect have they told you about?
A lot of them have had to really streamline their range, similar to us with our cakes, really. So Katie, who is allotment, she does our sourdough bread. And she used to make a lot of lunch items for us, but immediately when this happened, so she has two ladies working for her, one of whom was pregnant, so she had to go and isolate to be on the safe side, and the other one's nursery shut down. So she lost two-thirds of her workforce overnight. So now Katie on her own is just doing bread instead of doing all the other items, and some of her parents are doing the deliveries so she can get all the bread made on time.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's really nice because we get to see Katie's mum twice a week and have a chat. And every now and then we get to see Katie and it's a real treat. So, yeah, they've really had to kind of step back, go back to basics, and be really clever about what they're offering. What's been really odd is there doesn't seem to be any trend with the bigger wholesalers. And in a way, it's quite comforting to know that they don't know what to do either. In the first couple of weeks, was they all dropped their minimum orders massively because they wanted to help out the small businesses, you know. So we saw minimum orders of £250 go down to £100. But now what's happened is it's gone entirely the other way because the demand for small local businesses is so high. The minimum order is now £500 because the demand on these wholesalers is so huge that they can't keep up.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting... That's a total turnaround, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But as I say, no one really knows what's going to happen. So no one really knows what the best course of action is. So it's a bit kind of suck it and see, really. And you try one thing out, and if that works, you go with it. But then everything might change 2 days later, and you have to really back up and kind of think again and think around your problems, really. Mm. My main concern... There are five of us working at the moment and, you know, we're such a close-knit team. So we had to make the decision to shut 2 days a week to make sure we all get a weekend. Because it's still quite a stressful environment. We've got a very controlled environment, but,
you have.
You know, we're sending food out to vulnerable people, so we have to be really hot on our hygiene. You know, we have to get it right every time. So we made the decision to do reduced hours, so we're not rushing around, so we won't make any mistakes. We all get 2 days off a week, so we're rested because there's no point one of us getting it. The first week, we were kind of rushing around so much. We were all eating so poorly. So what we do now is every day we all make lunch for each other. Someone takes a turn and we make a really nice, kind of nutritious, healthy lunch.
Things have normalised in an inverted commas, haven't they? It's strange.
No, we've absolutely kind of hit our stride with our new opening hours. Now how to do. We're doing contactless doorstep collections, which are working really well. We're doing the odd delivery, but it's things we're not used to doing. We've never done it as a business. So it's learning from your mistakes and trying to streamline it as you go while the demand is so high. It's quite a difficult thing to do, and you're kind of constantly problem solving and trying to work around issues. But yeah, I think we're there now. There's still work to be done, but we're doing all right.
What's been the sort of customer response? Have you had any problems, or has it all been good from everybody's point of view?
We are incredibly lucky in that our customer base is wonderful. I think, again, that's one of the really lovely things that we've noticed is we've been thanked so many times by our customers. We've had customers bringing us gifts, and it's been really nice seeing people who have been isolating that we've managed to get food to. They're now coming into the shop, and they're so grateful we were able to get them that food. But we've only had the odd stinker, really. But I think what we're lucky in is that we are a really small shop, so unfortunately, if you're not very nice, we will remember your face.
Fair enough.
And as I say, for me, the priority is looking after your workforce at the minute and your team, because you're asking them to go above and beyond and to put themselves at risk.
True.
You know, they're out in public, even though we're wearing gloves and sanitising the shop every day, it's still a risk. So, you know, for me, if anyone is not very nice, that's kind of end of the line, really, with us saying hello to them.
In these times, it behoves everybody to be as nice to everybody else as they possibly can, and, as you say, always say thank you.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're so thankful that people are still shopping with us, because as a business, we are so, so lucky that we are doing okay for the time being. And touch with that continues, because we know so many of our kind of local food friends who have struggled and are struggling. Yeah, and it has brought out the very best in people, which is just wonderful, really.
Oh, it's lovely to hear that. Well, thank you so much. So that was Claire Rosier, the manager at Burwash Larder in Barton. And it's a lovely place. It's out in the countryside, not far from the centre of Cambridge, and well worth a visit if you've never been there before. Thanks ever so much, Claire.
Some news now. Scots All Day from Mill Road is delivering from an extensive menu using the main national food deliverers. But you can also collect from their Mill Road restaurant too. Just email scott@scotsallday.com, or you can phone Cambridge 311 105. And the Halloo Man is delivering in Cambridge on Saturdays from 5 till 9pm. Minimum order is 2 items, and there's Korean spicy chicken wings, halloumi buns, arancini, chickpea and potato shack. Details are on Instagram.
Azahar Food Van is delivering Spanish produce to your door. If you go to Click It Local, you'll find details of their products and prices. They're also on the market in Cambridge each Sunday from 8am.
And another local that you can find on Click It Local is Signorelli's Deli.
Kofco, which delivers organic veg boxes to Cambridge and the surrounding area, has opened its scheme to new customers. So if you'd like to order a box, go to the Kofco website.
I'm free.
In normal times, this is where we would bring you up-to-date details of free food available now in and around Cambridge. But we are pre-recorded, so we will suffice by saying that the information comes from the Olio app, which is free to download.
Yep, and the Olio app is in full flow. Some examples of what's been recently available include tins of plum tomatoes, long grain rice, tea bags and veggie straws.
And there is another free app called Too Good To Go, which several food outlets in and around Cambridge use to sell any unsold goods they have shortly before they close at knockdown prices. More news now. The Maypole Pub in Portugal Place is open from 12 till 2 and 5 till 8 p.m. daily for takeaway beers, lagers, ciders, wines and stone-baked pizzas. To order during opening hours, phone Cambridge 352 999. Out of hours, phone 07921 655 765. Jack's Gelato is open for collections and deliveries are coming soon. Current flavours include dark chocolate sorbet, rhubarb and hibiscus and lime. And those three are vegan. Yes, vegan chocolates. And there are seven other non-vegan flavours to try. A four-scoop tub is £10, 8-scoop is £18. Ordering information is on Instagram. Meadows of Eltersley Avenue is now operating online with lots of high-quality cheeses, vegetables, pulses, eggs, all sorts of things. Deliveries are Wednesdays and Saturdays. Online shop is at meadowscambridge.com.
Now, if you're a parent of children who might normally be at school, you might be running out of ways to keep them busy. What about teaching them to cook? Karen Allworth taught cookery to children prior to the lockdown, as did Tina Roche of Cambridge Cookery, who, as she explains, has years of experience.
Yeah, I've been teaching classes for children, well, for all ages, for over 10 years now, and I'm often totally delighted by how well the younger groups do, age groups do, and I guess to some extent the children who come to us are probably already fairly interested, otherwise it would be a cruel parent to send them, I suppose, if they had declared they weren't.
But what to cook?
We've always done proper cooking, so not making sort of fairy cakes and things like that. I think an obvious, very tactile activity, bread making and pasta making is always incredibly nice and really, really fun because it's not just chopping bits up and then putting them in a pan, which is kind of mechanical. And I would say the least interesting bit about cooking is to chop something up and then just, you know, fry it. And I'm not surprised if children find that only moderately interesting. But things like pasta making and bread making, where you're literally, it's alchemy, you know, you're turning really simple ingredients, like a bowl of flour and a bit of water, and in the case of bread, some yeast and salt, but in the case of pasta, just egg and flour. And then it's kind of Play-Doh-like to deal with it and knead it and use your hands and actually be encouraged to get your fingers there stuck in. And so I think those two activities are absolute revelations because the end result is so delicious. You know, fresh bread rolls or homemade pasta. So those two are obvious ones, and they're nice to do with fairly young children, I think, and it does need a parent to supervise. But I think otherwise, for slightly older children, I absolutely can't see why you wouldn't just cook real food. So I've been harping on for over 10 years now the importance of eating food that is created from scratch, from proper ingredients. And making a roast chicken, why wouldn't you learn that at the age of 6? Because all you do is put some herbs and seasoning, and in my case, a sort of a lemon that I pierce a bit so that it can leak out when it's inside, in a roasting tin. And a child might need help, depending on how high the oven is, to put it in and take it out once it's hot. But super easy food, and really quite impressive for a small child to see a roast chicken and think, I made that. Or fish. Fish is really quick, really, really quick.
And fish was mentioned by Karen Allworth from Always Time to Bake.
We are doing a fish pie using phyllo pastry. The children will make their own little cream cheese filling using, I decided it would be quite Mediterranean, so it was herbs and lemon, garlic, onion. So they do that, they taste it. I want them to taste it. And then we basically spread our whitefish with that, and we put it in phyllo, which is another ingredient which is loads of fun, not that familiar to many people, and so instantly they're interested. They don't believe it's pastry.
Tina also said that cooking can rid children of any food dislikes they have.
Cooking raw fish, it's sort of, there's no need to restrict what you encourage your children to cook, and any food fads or worries that they might have towards certain food groups, for instance fish or vegetables, tend to just vanish when they're allowed to prepare it themselves. And often one of the first reactions we get from at least half the parents is, I just can't believe my child just had that, because at home they say they don't like it.
I asked Tina about possible dangers in the kitchen.
We introduced knife skills for teenagers several years ago, and we've been successfully running that without any horrible incidents for many years now. And you can do a lot in the kitchen without a sharp knife, and as a very gadget adverse cook, I believe actually all you do need in the kitchen is one good knife. At some point you need to teach safety, so it's a bit like, you know, at what age do you allow your child to go out in the traffic? Perhaps you start with allowing them to cycle with you and cycle behind you, etc., and then gradually you allow them. It's the same sort of thing. You might as well start at a fairly early age, supervised, and obviously at an age where they can comfortably hold a knife, and a knife that fits their hand size-wise. But holding off and telling them that it's really, really dangerous, or even sort of telling them off if they try, and then suddenly expect them to be able to do it when they're teenagers, well, that won't really work. So I think you just have to be, you know, your own child, and they can usually do a lot more than you think. But also teaching how to hold a knife properly, and how to hold the piece of food with your left hand if you're a right-handed person is at least as important, because there's a very, very clear technique which will always save you from cutting yourself. And, you know, once we feel we've instilled that, I feel quite relaxed.
You don't want to choose something to cook that takes too long to prepare. You don't want motivation to run out, and that's so difficult to judge. Here's Karen Allworth.
Usually I do hold their attention for a good hour, hour and a quarter. The older children, it's anything from 2.5 to 5 or 6 hours.
And motivation can be reduced by being negative. Tina again.
Don't start with a long list of what could possibly go wrong or what they couldn't do. I just think, just be sensible, obviously, washing your hands, and they do need help with hot surfaces, obviously, and sensible things, like you wouldn't put them in front of a pan full of hot oil to deep fry something. As the first thing, and obviously not to cut a salad that you're going to eat raw after you've had raw chicken on it. But that is so much common sense that most children almost know it instinctively. So there aren't that many rules. I think it should just be, it should be relaxed and joyous, and as unsupervised as it's possible to do while still being safe. Because who enjoys just having someone picking on you all the time and telling you every second what you should be doing or how you would like to do it, or telling you, why don't I do that for you instead? You know, we would all loathe whatever activity we're trying to learn if someone, you know, taught us like that. And I think children are the same.
And at the end, you eat it.
And that, you know, I love the whole process of cooking, but the whole idea of cooking and the whole purpose of cooking for me is that joy that comes at the end when you sit down to a table. And but I think when we see our fairly young children sit down together with the bowls of food in front of them that they have made, and serving each other, sort of pouring out of the carafes of water, and it's very civilised and usually lovely.
And that was Tina Roche of Cambridge Cookery and Karen Allworth of Always Time to Bake. Tristan Welch has a different take on this. He talks to his children about academic subjects through the medium of cooking, and more about that later in the programme. And that music normally signals time for the latest food tweets from the city for today, Saturday.
But today we'll use it to remind you that, as well as being on Twitter, Flavour can be found on Instagram too, at Flavour105. We haven't said much so far, but we will.
Cambridge Cookery is now open from 9 till 1, Wednesday to Sunday, where you can collect everything you could want for breakfast, including baguettes, focaccia, yoghurt and granola, and croissants. They're also doing light lunches, including salads. It's all homemade, and there's plenty of space for safe queuing. Recipes can be found on their website too. Look for What's for Supper in their menu and click on the pics. And Indra is back. Indra will be preparing takeaway evening meals and barbecue marinated dishes at Cambridge Cookery from 9 until 1 on Thursday to Sunday. Take your own container. No advanced ordering, just turn up.
Bagel Box is still delivering freshly baked bagels to your door, though they're not to be found on Cambridge Market at the moment. You'll need to order by midday on Friday for Saturday delivery. The website is bagelbox.co.uk.
Linton Kitchen is delivering and allowing collections too. Ordering times are before midnight on Saturday for Monday delivery or collection, before midnight on Monday for Wednesday, and before midnight on Wednesday for Friday. Check their website for where they deliver to and when they're open for collections. It's store.thelintonkitchen.com.
We heard before from Simon Steele, who has a weekly stall on Cambridge Market, and this month is his 20th anniversary on the market. So I asked him how the market had changed in that time.
When you started, was the market very different then?
Very, very different. There were no hot food stalls. The only hot food was Pam and Tony in the caravan at the far end. The whole market was full of arts and crafts producers, which was really lovely. And on the farmer's side, there were five of us selling vegetables, and there were meat producers, fishmongers. Sylvia was here in those days. Very, very different market.
Right,
very
but different five market. Vegetable yes. sellers. So,
but we were all small growers. The first few weeks, I actually shared one of the fishmonger schools.
What about customers? I mean, what's happened to the number of customers, would you say?
Over the 20 years, it has expanded. I mean, we've still got some of the original customers as well. I mean, there are still half a dozen, perhaps even more than that, of customers that we served all those years ago.
The produce you sell, has that changed? Have people's tastes changed?
People, yes, they have. Things like when we first started, things like kohlrabi, we used to have to give it away because no one would touch it until they got to try it and use it, and then they came back and had it more. And spinach and chard and that sort of thing. We sell a lot more now than we did.
Well, I'm surprised that you started with kohlrabi then, because it's not an obvious...
It was one that we used to grow a lot of. We used to supply various box schemes.
And what got you into it?
I mean, I'm a nth generation farmer. All the family are based in Heathrow, down in London. We go back London, Ealing, Hammersmith. Even apparently they claim that we actually farmed in Knightsbridge at one point.
Gosh.
Used to have our own stall in Covent Garden Market, and that was the family business. And then we gradually moved down to my grandfather, moved on to Heathrow prior to it being an airport.
When Heathrow was just a little village.
It was indeed, yes. But yes, before it was an airport of any scale.
Right.
And his old farmhouse is still on the edge of the runway. You can still see the edge of some of the foundations of it.
And then what, you bought some land or rented some land?
I rented. We're county council tenants up here. Both Shell and I really didn't feel comfortable living at the edge of Heathrow. You know, it was increasingly busy. We've got a young family at that point, and we would really wanted to go off on our own if we could. And Cambridgeshire County Council were advertising holdings, and we applied and were very fortunate in getting it. Then. That was in 91, 92.
And the business has grown since then? Presumably you started small, did you?
We did start small, and we expanded into the wholesale. We were supplying various wholesalers in those days. And I was also working at a local salad factory at night. So we were running both simultaneously. But yes, the market side has expanded obviously dramatically, but in terms of volumes, we were probably growing more produce then, but we were all selling it all wholesale, which meant that the returns were minimal. I know the first day we were here, we came and we bought 4 boxes of spring green and 8 boxes of broad beans, and that was our sum total sale. And we actually took more, dare I say it, we took more home out of that than we did for about 3 days working for the wholesalers, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to go onto the markets. But in terms of volume, until 6 weeks ago, our volume had probably increased every year several hundred percent.
Do you think your customers are aware this is your 20th anniversary year?
No idea.
You ought to celebrate it. Are you going to celebrate it?
Don't know. I don't know what's appropriate to celebrate it now.
These aren't celebratory times, really, are they?
Not at the moment, no. We'll hold fire until... Because it's the 20th year, so at some point in the year, I'm sure we can have a celebration. It's like the egg hunt, Easter egg hunt. I mean, yeah, we always used to do the Easter egg hunt for the kids and the not-so-young kids. You know, we used to have lots of people that... Yeah, single people that used to say, "Oh, this is an Easter egg I get," and we used to distribute little chocolate eggs throughout the produce, and people said, "Oh, yeah, it's the only egg I get," which was nice, and so yeah, I've still got the eggs at home, and hopefully they'll come out at some point in the future, and we can have our belated Easter egg hunt.
Yes, well, that would be nice. And what about memorable events? Is anything any?
Well, we've had. I mean, obviously, bar this now, we've had times when we didn't know we were going to get here or not because of the frost and the snow. Back in, I can't remember exactly, was it 99 or 2000, when we had those minus 10s and minus 18s, and as the veg was coming off the van, it was freezing solid, and we were making snowmen, the lads were making snowmen in the roads, and yeah, so those sort of events probably more than anything else, and just seeing families come along and grow, and you know, so we've gone from bump to teenagers and off to university, and that sort of really to me is what it's all been about.
Yeah. Right, so you're not anxious to stop then, you're enjoying it?
I wouldn't know, no, I couldn't. I really don't want to stop.
Yeah.
I don't see any need or desire to stop, and we're just pleased that, you know, people are still willing to come out and come and see us and share the time with us, which is great.
Lovely. Okay, thanks very much, Simon.
Pleasure.
That was Simon Steele from the Sunday Market.
Dolcedo is open for takeaways in Hills Road, 7:30 a.m. until 3 p.m. Monday to Saturday in its last month of trading. And Milton Brewery opened last weekend for takeaways and in smaller quantities than they used to sell. As we prepare for this programme, we have no update, but keep an eye on their Twitter and Instagram pages.
Garden Kitchen is delivering on Fridays. Minimum spend £20 and the price includes delivery. For details, put Garden Kitchen Delivers into your search engine, and deliveries are to CB1 to 5 and orders need to be placed by Wednesday. Meadow Kitchen is delivering meals for reheating. A couple of recent examples: braised carrot and chickpea stew with herb marinated feta, baby potato, shallot and bean bake with almond and herb salsa. It's £7 a pot or £25 for 4 pots, which are 16 ounces in size. Details in the Meadow Kitchen website.
Going back to that earlier item about teaching cookery to your children, Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern has a different approach. Alan asked him about it.
Well, me being a chef, I do a lot of it in cooking. So we do some maths with sort of weighing and measuring and stuff. So that's one cooking lesson. We do geography with another cooking lesson. We choose a country and we talk about it and we cook one of their regional dishes. And then for languages, we do French patisserie. So each week we do a cookery class in French. And like last week was creme caramel, which is so there's 3 cookery classes now.
Oh, wow.
in the curriculum.
So there's plenty to eat every day then.
Oh, you don't go hungry in our house? No, absolutely not. I'm surprised you did, because I know we don't live that far from each other, but I'm surprised you didn't see the smoke coming out the back of my kitchen Sunday morning. I almost set fire to the whole place because I made fresh croissants for Sunday morning. I thought it'd be a lovely sort of treat for the family. And of course, the butter, and I put them on the wrong tray, so the butter ran out onto the bottom of the oven, and I opened the door, and the smoke bellowed out. Oh, I was surprised the fire brigade didn't turn up, just thinking the whole place was on fire.
Sorry, I was going to ask you as well if you had any advice on home teaching your own children.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of really good things that we do which helps. We tune in every day to English with Holly, and that's a Facebook group, and that's an English teacher from I believe. She's fantastic, and my kids follow that every weekday at 11 a.m. and that really helps as well. But other tips of what we're doing as well is I tend to do one lesson, and then I make them do something active so they can bounce up and down on the trampoline, or they do the Joe Wicks workout or something like that, and then they're back to another lesson. And if I can do it even at the weekends, I do, just because the kids have got a routine or something to do. It's a big challenge.
And is discipline good?
I've got three boys. Two of them are 10, and my youngest has just turned 8. So when they want to turn against me, I'm completely outnumbered.
Okay, so your training as a chef probably comes in quite handy, actually. You've run a few kitchens in your time.
That was Tristan Welch, who has some very watchable live features on Instagram 3 times a week.
On our last programme, Sarah Lavelle from Quadrille Books talked about what cookbooks were currently selling well, and one that she mentioned in particular was Super Sourdough by James Morton. And here is Sarah talking with me about it last September, and she begins by explaining that this is James' second book about bread.
He did a book called Brilliant Bread probably about 7 years ago now, because he did that after he'd appeared on Great British Bake Off, and he was on the third series of Great British Bake Off, and we're now on the 10th one, so it must have been.
And this one is specifically about sourdough. So what does this bring to us, this book?
It's called Super Sourdough, and in Brilliant Bread he did a section on sourdough, but I don't think covered it in as much detail as it was possible in that first book, because there's so much to say about it. And I think even in the 7 years since he published that book, sourdough has just exploded in terms of popularity. I mean, it's everywhere. If you go into a cafe these days and have toast, it's going to be sourdough, isn't it? And it's so complex in terms of flavour. I think people become quite obsessed with it, you know. People are very competitive and they challenge themselves and they want to do the best sourdough. It's very Instagrammable. So it's just become this almost like a cult food stuff. And things can go wrong. And so what James wanted to tackle in Super Sourdough is basically how to turn out perfect sourdough loaves and to understand the process, so that if it doesn't work out quite right, you know what you might have done wrong and change it for next time. And I tried, lucky enough to be at the photo shoot, and tried most of the things he made, and they were amazing. I mean, all his breads are amazing. Again, he's a brilliant tester of recipes, and I'm sort of in awe as to his skills with bread.
Well, in a way, I suppose the structure of the book is similar to Sour, isn't it? There's quite a lengthy introduction. Yes. Which explains things. And as somebody who makes sourdough myself, I've made it for long enough to know that it's going to turn out okay, but I don't really know what I'm doing, so that limits me in experimentation. But he's got how you do it, a sort of, I suppose, concise... Yeah. Bit, hasn't he? And then there's a section that explains why you do that, which is terribly useful.
Yeah,
and accessible.
One whole section, which is a pain au levain, which he says the longest and most important recipe you'll ever read.
Is that the one where he says how much you like it? There is a bread in there.
Oh no, that's pain de mie.
Right.
Yeah, so he has a very sort of concise version, and when I was first working on the book, I just followed his concise version, and it worked, and I made the best sourdough I think I've ever made just by absolutely following what James says in these instructions. And then he's got a longer version of it which breaks down every point so that you understand exactly what's going on and why you're doing the things you're doing. And you know, he encourages people to just experiment and have a go, and if it goes wrong, you know, it's not a huge disaster. Usually you can produce something edible, let's face it. But also, you could produce loaves that are, you know, worthy of being in a bakery. One of the things I liked is that he offers some schedules as well as to how to fit making sourdough around your day. Like if you get up and go to work, here are the things you can assemble, and then you have, you know, bread ready when you come home. He doesn't go in for spending hours and hours kneading. Lots of these, you sort of mix it up, and there's this process called autolyse, where you leave the ingredients sort of sit there pre-salt, and then once you've mixed everything together, really all you have to do is sort of keep folding occasionally. Every time, he says, every time you walk past it, give it a bit of a fold over. He's keen that making sourdough fits around people's lives.
Yes. Well, yeah. Well, that's important, isn't it? Because a lot of methods are very intrusive into your life. There's some unusual breads there as well, like bolillo or bolillo, which is apparently a Mexican bread.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. And he uses some grains you might not have heard of. They're sort of ancient grains that I think have fallen out of fashion, but are making a comeback. I mean, he even does mill some of his own flour. But he's got a recipe for pretty much every kind of bread you can make, and there's not a packet of dried yeast in sight. It's all sourdough.
Yeah. That's impressive. That's impressive. He also, at the end, he has ways in which you can use leftover starter as well.
Yes, which I hadn't thought of. I don't think I have ever used leftover starter. But even, pappardelle, pasta.
And crumpets.
Crumpets, pancakes.
Cornbread.
Yeah, and he's got some lovely sweet... It's not just bready bread. He's got lovely sweet dishes, amazing brioche. And I had pleasure of trying the Kugelhopf, which is a cherry Kugelhopf, which was just glorious, absolutely glorious.
Well, actually, in the acknowledgements at the end, that you and your family are thanked greatly, and Tim Haywood and his family too. So what went on?
Well, I think every one of the of James's past few books we've shot in Cambridge, because he's based in Glasgow. And I work in London. So Cambridge is sort of a convenient middle place. And Tim and his family have been kind enough to give up they've got a bit of studio space for us to shoot the book. And in the process, James and the whole team have become very good friends with Tim and family, with my family. So, yeah, it's a really nice process.
Okay, but no recipe for Chelsea buns.
No, not in that one. We're saving that up for the Fitzbillies cookbook.
So when's that coming out then?
Hopefully November. I have it in time for Christmas, and it will be available from Fitzbillies shops and bookstores. And it will be not only recipes from Fitzbillies, but a celebration of Cambridge.
Right, and presumably something of the history of Fitzbillies.
Yes,
in there.
Which is really fascinating.
So Tim has written it, I guess.
Tim's written that in super fast speed. Tim and Alison have written it, and with recipes from some of the chefs and bakers at Fitzbillies. Yeah.
And photos, old photos?
Yeah, a few old photos, but all new photography of the food and lots of lovely location photography of Cambridge. And from the cafes.
Well,
yeah.
That's something really to look forward to.
I know.
To,
well, we haven't got a copy yet, but I can't wait to see it.
Yeah. And what format is it? How big is it?
It's a large format cookbook.
Right. So it's not a huge coffee table book that can't handle easily.
No. It's all around the food. Yeah. It's a sort of £20 cookbook size.
Oh, that's brilliant. I really look forward to that. Anyway, that was Super Sourdough by James Morden, who does write a lot of books. And they're all very thorough.
They're very thorough. Yeah, that's out in... Coincidentally, it's out for Sourdough September, which is a thing.
Is it? Right. OK. Although I must say, I noticed that in the back of the sour book that we talked about before, there was a recipe for sourdough soup.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, sourdough soup.
So that's something else that's worth trying, isn't it? Yeah.
And that was Sarah Lavelle from Quadrille. Super Sourdough is by James Morton, and the book mentioned right at the end there, Sour, is by Mark Diacono, also highly recommended. Now, we heard earlier in the programme about Tristan Welch and his excursion on Instagram Live. Another famous Cambridge foodie name to take the plunge with this thoroughly modern tech is Sam Owens of Thirsty on Chesterton Road, and of course, Thirsty and Hungry on King Street. Now, Sam's business specialises in beer and wines, and he's always keen to help people navigate what some see as the rather stuffy provincial world of wines, and he does it with his own light touch and a bit of fun. Now, with the coronavirus lockdown, Sam wants to introduce the wine and beer producers to the public in a safe, socially responsible way, and taste their wares whilst doing it. Cue Sam's debut next week on Instagram Live, starting on Tuesday with Justin, the producer behind the fabulous B-side Grenache from the Roussillon region of southern France.
It would just be my ugly mug next Tuesday with Justin. It'll just be, you know, half the screen will have Justin, who's a lot smoother looking fella than I am. And then, I don't know, what do you want to call them? Viewers, customers, people can fire those questions in. So, I mean, I'm sort of hosting the shindig, and Justin is he's a really cool guy. He used to be the head buyer of Waitrose, also at Laithwaite's. He's a master of wine, which is one of only about 300 or so people that have done a heck of a lot of studying. He's got this little domain down in the south of France, little estate. You know, it's not a grandiose chateau or anything like that, but a few hectares of vines in the foothills of the Pyrenees. And he's just a really interesting guy with an awful lot of perspectives and stories to tell of the wine game.
How did you come to meet him?
How did I meet him? That's a bloody good question. He, having been quite high profile at places like Waitrose and Laithwaite's, and then deciding, stuff that all for a laugh, I'm going to go and make a bit of wine in a halfway up a mountain in a field in France. Quite a nice tale. And then the wines are superb. And then the wine that's really taken off with us there of his wines, it's called the B-side. So his property is called Domain of the Bee, as in bzzz. His second wine is called the B-side. The label is in the style of a record label, visually and with the wording, and people, our customers have just loved it. It's a flipping lovely wine. It's great marketing. It's great, you know, he's a canny operator.
And of course you stock quite a few of his wines.
Well, yeah, he makes a beautiful pink wine, a beautiful rosé, so just lovely sort of pale, dry, crisp, exactly what you think you need on a, you know, nice early summer. Transport yourself to the Côte d'Azur, if you like. You know, a lovely white as well, which we've just received the new vintage of that. On top of that all, you make some really big, quite thumping red wines, which perhaps more for drinking in the winter.
Later in May, you have another online tasting, courtesy of Instagram Live. This time it's going to be with Arnold Holzer, yes?
So yes, that's about thinking about how do you, in this restricted world, how do you bring the topic to life a bit more than just simply, here's some wine, you can click on this button and then wallop, pay for it. How can we just bring that more to life? So if we can't have you come in here and we can't have producers or brewers come here and chat to you and tell you about their stories, well, how about we come to you? So we can do that thanks to these other tools. I've been speaking to a number of our producers, our wine producers and brewers, about getting them involved with these events. We've got Arnold Holzer, who's a great bloke. He's from Austria. He's a young guy, not even 30. He's a great laugh. I've had a few nights out with him when he's been up here in London and is not any pretty. But he makes some cracking wines, some Grünefeldtiner, some lovely reds and a pink. We're actually going to distribute 100ml bottles of the wines. I'll decant the wines from the normal bottles into these small sample bottles, which I will then whisk around to the event participants the afternoon of the event, probably with some fancy cheeses as well. Everyone will be able to participate with the product, as well as then meet Arnold, and Arnold will show us all around his winery, show us hopefully into his vineyards. And
oh, great stuff.
Just bring it to life, which is cool. And we're doing that again, probably be into June, with a producer in Kent called Westwell, who makes some absolutely stonking wines down near Ashford. Who else we've got? I mean, I've just been chatting to a number of our guys, and everyone's up for it. We've got Track, who are a brilliant brewery up in Manchester. They're lined up on the 28th of May. And we've got Pastore. Yeah, so Pastore, our local mixed fermentation brewery. So they're making beers that are sort of more natural, sour, wild, however you want to describe them. Not your sort of classic IPAs, hoppy pails, etc. So I've known Chris and Ben for about 10 years or so. And we've got them lined up next Thursday, the 14th at 6 p.m. again on Instagram Live. Put a pack of five of their beers together, including four actually that were only canned and bottled on Tuesday this week, so they're as fresh as can be.
Oh yeah.
So you can get the five pack on our website and then tune in on next Thursday evening, and again it'll be me on one half of the screen and Chris and Ben, father and son team, up at the brewery in Waterbeach.
So you're a salesman, an entrepreneur and a compere as well.
Yes, I suppose so. I've always used my mouth a lot.
I find all this technology just fantastic. It's
it has its place, doesn't it? Just like it can coexist alongside radio and the internet and TV and everything else. And it's just brilliant. I think, you know, it's more information, it's more help to the customer, and it's more to keep them informed.
Well, do you know what, Matt? I think, in a funny way, I think all sorts of completely unexpected effects are going to come from this. And just looking in one very tiny, small context of wine and of beer, and I've always been conscious that whenever you put an event on tasting, or you get a brewer to come along and you invite people to come, either just come and turn up, or it's quite intimidating for people. Mm. And I'm very aware of that, and it's entirely fair enough, because, you know, these, I don't know, maybe especially with wine, it's really complex and it's a bit scary, and maybe they're from, the producer's from France and doesn't speak much English, or, you know, it's quite an off-putting concept, I think, for a lot of people. And of course, to go and visit those guys, you've got to get off your backside and you've got to travel to a vineyard or a brewery, and that might be overseas. It's not easy.
Yeah.
Whereas now, well, you haven't got that as an option, but we can bring, or the guys can come to you. Now, that's probably not something that we would have all taken very seriously 6 weeks ago. No, I think that's wonderful, because, you know, you can, as a, if you're interested in a beer or beers, or you're interested in wines, you can sit in your PJs at home. You want to try these wines with a bag of Wotsits, absolutely no problem whatsoever. No one's ever going to know. So it sort of makes it almost more, democratizes it, or at least just simplifies it. And I think that's a really interesting idea. And I'm very intrigued to explore that and try to get more of the brilliant people that make all this fantastic grog. You know, get more of them and their stories and their insights and their eccentricities, and share that with as many people as we can.
That's great. And that was, of course, one of the main tenets of the Thirsty Ethos, wasn't it? It was to demystify the wine trade, to make it more accessible to people.
I'm obviously not somebody who sits around with a cravat and a silver spoon inserted where the sun doesn't shine. I'm fascinated by the whole thing. And it's, you know, I've spent the best part of 20 years now working in this field. But ultimately, I look at this stuff and think, this is happy juice. You know, this is stuff that should put a smile on your face. You shouldn't have to deconstruct it and regard it like some sort of religion or cult, or, you know, something incredibly serious to genuflect before. It's stuff that should make you happy. That should, and I don't mean that make you happy, make you drunk, but make you happy with food, with friends, with your wife, you know. And that's what I try to bring to it, I suppose. That's how I look at it. And if I can share that approach, that attitude with the people that come into contact with Thirsty, then, you know, that's very satisfying.
Very satisfying. And listeners, you can see the results of that at the first Instagram Live on Tuesday the 12th of May at 6 p.m. How does the listener find you?
So you just go to Instagram and search for Thirsty Cambridge. Yeah, we'll be there Tuesday 6 p.m. with Justin Harris-Need, and then back again on Thursday at 6 with the Pastoria Boys.
Lovely. Roll on the events and good luck with them. Nice to catch up with you again, Sam.
Cheers, Matt. Thanks a lot.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. And that's all the time we have for today. Don't forget, we are here on alternate Saturdays at 1, repeated on Sundays at 2, and then podcast early in the next week.
Coming up after the news on Cambridge 105 Radio today is Bookmark. In an edition first broadcast in 2014, Lee Chambers and Alex Rusha interview Karen Freeborn, whose death was announced recently. She was a gritty socialist realist writer and a creative writing tutor at Anglia Ruskin University. Karen talks about growing up in the East End with Ronnie Cray as a family friend and the lasting influence her childhood has had on her writing. Very gritty indeed. But that's all from us here on Flavour. We'll be back on the 23rd of May. But until then, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.